Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Robert Huebner. I'm a postdoc in John Molnerford's lab, and I've been working on convergent extension in Xenopus laevis. And I'm going to start the talk just by kind of discussing how we're thinking about convergent extension in the Xenopus now. And then I'm going to show you some of my own data. And I'm going to finish by talking about a transcriptional profiling experiment that we're starting in the lab. And it's going to be a little bit of a tease. It's a very new project, but I want to talk about it. So convergent extension is a collective process of cell motility. Once you have a cluster of cells such as this, and these cells will converge on a midline, and they'll extend the axis of this piece of tissue. So convergent extension is conserved process of cell movements, and this is conserved from Drosophila to mammals. And here you're extending the anterior, posterior, or head to tail axis. So the model system I work in is the Xenopus laevis, and this is a classic model system for studying vertebrate embryology. So here on the left, I'm showing two of these frogs. This is a female, this is a male. The females are actually quite large, about the size of my hand. And these animals are really useful for embryology because of each clutch, they give you a large number of embryos, so hundreds. And these embryos undergo a synchronized and stereotyped development. These embryos are also quite large, so you can directly inject proteins, mRNAs, now CRISPRs, into these cells up to the 32-cell stage. And we actually have the lineages traced from this point, so you can really do targeted injections. So Xenopus establishes the anterior-posterior axis during gastrulation through involution and elongation of the presumptive mesoderm. So these are the cells labeled in red here. These cells will involute and then underneath the ectoderm, and then they will undergo convergence and extension to elongate the anterior-posterior axis. At the same time, they'll pull the ectoderm underneath, and this establishes the three germ layers. And all of this starts at a region of the embryo known as the dorsal marginal zone. And what's very cool is that you can actually surgically isolate the dorsal marginal zone, put it in culture, and it will undergo convergence extension kind of all on its own. So now we can do imaging experiments, sequencing, biochemistry. So this allows us to do ex vivo subcellular time-lapse studies of convergent extension. So this is one of these dorsal marginal zones, labeled with a membrane GFP. This is a mesenchyme, so you can see these cells are incredibly protrusive. They're interdigitating around each other, and they're elongating and polarizing along this mediolateral axis.
Sorry, are we just looking at the single cut?
No, this is max intensity projection.
So those things could be surfaces cut through the mesenchyme.
So up here, the embryos, the marginal zones will occasionally bend or buckle. So if you're seeing there's kind of a slight tilt at the top of this embryo, you might be noticing, or the marginal zone.
But it's one layer thick, you don't have.
We can see one layer deep into it. It's more like 3 to 4 cell layers thick. There's a ton of yolk in these cells, so we really get just kind of the one cell layer that's at the interface with the glass.
Phenotypically, yeah. What is the difference between the in vivo and ex vivo extension? Do you see a difference in the extent of the...
So it depends a little bit on culture conditions. We actually culture our marginal zones on fibronectin, and they don't elongate quite as much as in culture. If you actually take the dorsal marginal zone and just put it in a fluid, it elongates pretty much to the extent you see in the embryo. So there's kind of been a long-standing traditional model for a cellular mechanism that drives Xenopus convergent extension. I mentioned, I think we're kind of moving away from this model now in the Molnerford lab. But here, the thought was that these mesenchymal cells form lamellipodia. These lamellipodia become polarized, attached to neighbors, and there's kind of a pulling or constriction force that results in this cell rearrangement. And I think the reason they kind of initially developed this model is they were just looking at the very bottom of these cells. If you look at the very bottom, these cells right at the glass interface, you do see these beautiful lamellipodia and actin dynamics, but they're actually missing out on most of the cells. So a number of years ago, a postdoc in the lab named Asako Shindo decided to look just a few microns above these lamellipodia. And what you saw was these actually really nice defined membranes, no lamellar structures, things like this shrinking junction process.
When you say above the lamellipodia, which way up are we imaging from below? Right?
So, yeah, if the marginal zones kind of place...
Getting deeper into the tissue.
Getting deeper into the cells, correct.
Okay, yeah. I thought I was imaging from above, so I think that'd be nice.
Yeah, we're imaging from below, so we're moving up into the cell.
Do you ever try placing it on, put it on peg surface and compressing so there's no adhesion? Because maybe those protrusions are all to do with fibronectin.
We haven't done that, but it is a possibility. Or it's a possibility that just being on the stiffness of the glass is making them protrusive. But what we now think is in the Wallingford lab is that the Xenopus mesenchyme is undergoing T1 transitions during convergent extension. So here, the process of a T1 constriction is what we have is a group of cells labeled 1, 2, 3, 4 here. And on the left, these cells have an anterior-posterior oriented junction. So that between cell 2 and 4, this junction will shrink, exchange, and then we'll have elongation of a new junction between these 1 and 3 cells. And this is what we call a T-junction along the mediolateral axis. And this is also a mechanism that can drive convergent extension.
So maybe this isn't important, but what's the difference between this and previous ideas?
So previous ideas was that the lamellae were reaching out and producing the force as they pulled the cells together. The thought here now is that the force is actually occurring on the shrinking junction. And the reason we think that is that the actomyosin machinery are localized directly on these what we call V-junctions that are shrinking. And actually, if you do like laser cut ablation experiments, we see that these shrinking V-junctions are under much more tension than other junctions in the embryo.
Okay, so it's where the force is coming from.
So it's where the force is coming from.
When you have an elongation then? Mm-hmm. When you have an elongation then?
So we don't understand the mechanism of the elongations quite yet.
What kind of junctions are these? These aren't epithelia.
Yeah, so they aren't epithelia. These are actually kind of very loose cell-cell contacts. So some of the experiments I'm going to be talking about are kind of us looking for the first time at the cell adhesions that are here. So we don't have tight junctions, we don't have adherence junctions, we don't have eke adherin. They're really kind of not well-defined.
But there is some junctions, just like on this diagram, it's just showing us two gaps. But
yeah, we'll get to that.
Okay.
So Asako also showed that polarization of the contractility machinery required planar cell polarity and septins. And so we'd actually known planar cell polarity was required for this convergent extension for quite a long time, but we didn't really know how. And what Asako showed is that planar cell polarity was required to localize the septins kind of to the end of these shrinking V-junctions. And the septins then compartmentalize this actomyosin machinery that then provides the force to shrink the junctions. So this kind of led to what has now been my first research project, which is how does cell adhesion interface with this actomyosin machinery and PCP to drive convergent extension. So we actually know very little about what's going on in this gap right here. And a logical target would be hit cell adhesion binding proteins that link the actin cytoskeleton to points of cell contact. But in the early embryo of Xenopus. We don't have E cadherin or N cadherin, which is what most people are kind of familiar with. Here are the dominant classical cadherins known as C cadherin. We know this is expressed in the early embryo, and that dominant negative C cadherin blocks convergent extension. So here is an experiment from Lee and Gumbiner. What they did is, on the bottom, we just have control marginal zones. They're nicely elongated. On the top, they injected a dominant negative C cadherin. You no longer have elongation in this tissue. So we developed a GFP fusion that now allows visualization of the C cadherin dynamics in real time during this junction shrinking. And the first thing we're going to do experimental here was ask, we just kind of to characterize the C cadherin dynamics. To do this, we use FRAP studies. So here we have our polarized cell expressing the C cadherin GFP. We bleach this region, bleach here, and then we follow the recovery of the protein fluorescence.
So all of these constructs, you're introducing these by injection at one cell? So.
Yes. Actually, usually injection at 2 to 4 cell stage when we can already see which side of the embryo will be dorsal.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And so do you have to worry about levels?
Yeah, we do have to kind of tune this. If you overexpress the C cadherin GFP, you block convergent extension. So it is kind of a balancing act, and it is overexpression. It's direct mRNA injection, but yeah.
So maybe now's a good time to ask, but haven't there been, or are you going to do just some TEM, so transmission electron microscopy sections through these cells in the embryo to see? Because you can just see junctions without having to know the proteins involved.
Well, you can, I guess you could see the lines of the junctions, but you'll miss any dynamics. And
yeah, but just to see what the junctions are, what the shapes are, you can tell a lot of information about what type of junction you might
get. Yeah, it might be a good idea to see if we see kind of the same junction angles, etc., or some of them much shorter along like the AP axis. Yeah, it's a good idea.
Unbiased.
Yeah. So FRAP provides two quantitative measures of protein dynamics. The first is T1/2, which is the halftime of fluorescence recovery. This is kind of used to assess how much the protein can diffuse within the membrane. The second quantitative measure is the mobile fraction. So this is the percentage of fluorescence that has recovered. And this is used as a measure to kind of determine how much of the protein is bound up in complexes versus how much of the protein is free to diffuse at any given point in time.
And can I also ask, did you see diffusion from the edges in? Because that
we'll get to that a bit later, yeah. So actually, in these initial experiments, my temporal resolution wasn't good enough to even see that. The first experiment we did was to compare FRAP for unpolarized cells in the dorsal marginal zone before convergence extension began versus the polarized cells that are undergoing convergence extension. We found there was a significant increase in the C cadherin mobile fraction in the polarized cells. So here on the left is the T1/2. There was a difference between unpolarized and polarized. On the right, we have the unpolarized cells polarized, and there is a significant difference in this mobile fraction. And so the thought here is that there's actually less of the C cadherin bound up in complexes in this polarized state than in the unpolarized state. And I think this makes sense because the cells are becoming highly motile, and I think you want to decrease your cell adhesion at this point.
Is it matter on which orientation the junctions are?
So this is just all of the junctions.
Yeah.
I guess you can't, because the way you're expressing the C cadherin, you don't know whether the absolute levels are rising, so it could be that the mobile and the immobile is rising, because you don't know how much protein is there. I mean, just the fraction doesn't tell you how much,
it
tells you the proportion between the two populations.
More protein coming in, though, you'll get a FRAP curve that goes way above 100% on the mobile fraction.
Yeah, but I'm saying that if there was more C cadherin in polarized cells, Your actual immobile fraction might be staying the same size, you might just have more immobile as well. So you don't necessarily know there's less cell adhesion unless you know how much absolute protein is there.
I think that's true. Yeah.
But I don't know whether you can get around that. That's my sort of, whether you've got a feeling for whether there is actually less cell adhesion there.
I don't think I know for sure there's less cell adhesion. I think that's the interpretation of the experiment. So the next logical experiment, are there differences in C-cation dynamics at the V versus the T junctions? So we frapped at the shrinking V junctions or the T junctions, and fortunately we found no difference in the motility between those two junction types. So on the left we're looking at T1/2, unpolarized cells at V or T junctions, no C-cation difference. On the right, we're looking at unpolarized versus polarized cells at V or T junctions. And there's this increase in mobile fraction I just talked about. But between the V and T junctions, it's not significantly different. And this was disappointing. So we really thought if the C-cation was playing a role in this junction shrinking, there'd be a difference in the junction dynamics.
But here in your example, the T junction are still very horizontal. A small one, but vertical.
We don't get a lot of purely vertical junctions in the tissue. It's all kind of differing angles.
And on the newly formed?
So we haven't done much at all with the newly formed junctions yet.
So but I guess a lot of the will of the newly formed because it's doing dynamics, it's doing cycles, right? It's probably doing cycles of mating exchange. So maybe a lot of them will be newly formed.
Yeah, it's measurable. It's fine. So. Potentially, yes, there are newly formed ones in here. It's possible, yeah. So this is just kind of averaging over a bunch. So we didn't see a difference in FRAP, so we just wanted to look and see if there was an enrichment for C-cation, specifically at the shrinking junctions. So previous work from Osako has shown phosphomycin is nicely polarized at these junctions. The polarization of the C-cation wasn't apparent as this, but we decided to go in and measure fluorescence intensity specifically at the V junctions. And then actually when we correlated this with junction length, we found that there was actually an enrichment for C-cation intensity, but only at the very shortest of these V junctions. Seeing that as junctions were decreasing in size, we're getting an increase in the C-cation.
Do you remove the 4-way vertices?
Remove the vertices?
In your calculation, because you often have a lot of myosin at their vertices. So we get it distorted. We get the same thing, but it might be an artifact.
We did not remove the vertices. We might have to go back in. So you're talking just measure very specifically here, not into that edge.
Yeah, so maybe.
The length is in what units?
The length is in microns. These cells are very long, often in that axis.
And we should ignore the bimodality at low edge lengths.
For now, yes. It's true. I think we'll kind of get to why we have this bimodality in just a little bit. And it has to do with how we think the junctions are shrinking.
Is this some sort of normalized intensity, or is it just
just normalized? Yeah.
Can I ask how thick are these cells?
I'm actually not completely sure, because if we go much above 10, 12 microns, we actually have a difficult time seeing the top of the cell. They're very yolky, and you just get a lot of diffraction. So we can't actually see all the way to the top of these cells.
Are these junctions on a line, or more on a surface region,
On a surface, going upward.
A surface of 2 microns, 5 microns?
I'd say they go all the way up to the 10 or so microns that we can see.
Okay, so it's a surface. Okay.
Next question is, how does C-cation interact with actin during convergent extension? Here we just express our C-cation GFP with a marker for actin. This is LifeAct RFP. And we looked in our dorsal marginal zones early before the cells had polarized, and we actually saw these kind of distinct domains that had either the actin or the C-cadherin. So this membrane kind of enriched for cadherin. These kind of fluctuating tricellular junctions seem to just have the actin, which is kind of surprising. Once the cells were polarized and undergoing convergent extension, we now saw that we had a good overlap of these two proteins. So my thought is that before they polarize, there's not a lot of tension in the cell. As these cells become polarized and start kind of pooling, the cadherins start interacting with the actomyosin machinery.
So when cells start to lose contacts, I mean to reduce their junction, is this reduction more basally and then it's propagated apically? Or is it more apically and then it's propagated basally? Or is it just the same?
So these regions here, where they kind of have loose cell contacts, is that what you're talking about?
In general, when they do the D1 transition.
Oh, that
I happened in one of the region of this plane before?
I actually don't know if it starts at the bottom and moves up or vice versa. Yeah. So again, from previous work in Osaka, we knew that there are actin pulses at the shrinking junctions. So as the junction shrinks, we see an enrichment for actin. So we wanted to see if the C-cadherin was also showing this kind of pulsile behavior. So again, I'm looking at life at RFP and cadherin GFP, just pointing at one of these shrinking B junctions. On the left, you can see the actin is kind of pulsing on and off. And on the right, I think it's subtle, but we're seeing kind of a similar fluctuation in cadherin intensity. So we still need to quantify this. But a kind of more interesting experiment getting to the same point is we went in and performed FRAP experiments specifically at these shrinking B junctions during the actin pulses. So on the left, I'm showing one of these pulses of actin enrichment. On the right, we FRAP the C-cadherin. And when we look at the FRAP recovery data, we see this huge spike in C-cadherin mobile fraction when we FRAP very specifically at the shrinking V junctions. So the thought is that the cadherin is being actively accumulated at these junctions during the actin pulses.
And this is much faster than in the other.
Yeah, so we're doing like 100 millisecond time scales now.
Is the total quantity increased, or is just that the density is increasing?
So I think the total quantity of the C-cadherin on the V-junction is increasing as you have this active shrinking with that actin pulse.
Beyond 150 seconds, is that how long it takes to shrink? I was wondering whether this is going to go on up to 200% or something. Is that what is happening? There's no sign of it on an asymptote yet.
It would be nice to extend beyond to see how far up this really does peak, but I have not done that yet.
Well, presumably the junction shrinks. I don't know how fast the junction shrinks. Is that?
Well, that's on the scale of like 10 minutes for a full shrinking. So these time scales are very different, which makes these very difficult experiments because the actin flashes are very short, but the junction shrinking takes quite a while.
You wouldn't be having to manually track this as well, are you?
Not yet. There's been a lot of just.
Okay.
A lot of repeating. So just a simple model so far is that there's concurrent enrichment of actin and C-cadherin as this junction is shrinking, which led us to ask, how is the C-cadherin loaded onto the shrinking junction? So here we're thinking we have lateral flow or some sort of membrane trafficking. So again, we return to FRAP experiments, but here we use very high temporal resolution, so we can hopefully see the dynamics of the protein in real time. So if we look at a single one of the B junctions, this is the cadherin, we FRAP, and then we see a nice lateral movement of the seek adherent onto the junction.
Is the whole junction, is the whole junction getting narrower? Is that reference frame moving, you see what I mean?
Yeah, I might be a little bit more zoomed in here than I was previously, so you can't see the edges of it. Yeah, maybe I should step.
Well, I guess it's a question of whether the actual, what's happening to the membrane? I mean, is it just sort of compressing the, is there lots of membrane now, is it just sort of concatenating the membrane?
I don't think it's compressing the membrane, because the membrane doesn't fold. I think there must be membrane taken out somehow as the junction is shrinking. It's
interesting to have a membrane marking at the same time, to see if it's getting denser or not.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good idea, yeah.
Well, yeah.
So we think the adherents are moving laterally onto these shrinking junctions from these side membranes. Finally, we wanted to get to planar cell polarity. So we know planar cell polarity is kind of, we think, the upstream driver in this entire process. We know it localizes the septins to kind of the sides of the shrinking junctions, and the septins then help localize the actin-myosin contractility to the junction. So we wanted to thus disrupt planar cell polarity here. And so a number of years ago, John showed that disheveled is required for both polarization and elongation of these cells during convergent extension. And he developed a mutant of disheveled XBD1 that blocks this process, and also showed that high levels of overexpression of disheveled also block convergent extension. So we used this mutant and co-expressed it with seek adherent GFP, and then again wanted to look at frac dynamics of the seek adherent with this mutant protein. And unfortunately, again, there was no difference in seek adherent dynamics when we compared the control versus the mutant. But actually, kind of looking back at this experiment might have been a little bit kind of unsophisticated now that we're thinking the cadherins really only being enriched when you have enrichment of the actin, and that we might need to look a little bit closer than a simple FRAP experiment to see any differences here. Conclusions. Seek adherence seems to be enriched, but specifically at the shortest V junctions. And I think this enrichment is caused, or at least occurring concurrently with actin pulses. And we think the cadherin is being loaded into these V junctions from the lateral membranes. So,
let's see. Photoactivatable. So that might tell you where it was coming from.
Yeah, so we have photoactivatable actin. I'm making the construct with the cadherin. Yeah, so we'll be able to follow the dynamics much better with the photoactivatable construct. Really quickly, I want to talk about the second research project that I'm very excited about. And here, we're trying to identify novel regulators of convergent extension. What we're doing is a large-scale RNA sequencing time course of convergent extension. So the experimental design here is we're cutting out dorsal marginal zones, and then isolating RNA every 30 minutes from the beginning of gastrulation until the end of neurulation. As controls for these experiments, we're cutting out the ventral marginal zone, so this is a mesenchyme that doesn't undergo convergent extension. We're also cutting out the animal cap, and the thought is by taking these two tissues that don't undergo convergent extension, we can enrich in our data for convergent extension-specific genes. So this has given us five largely overlapping data sets. Each of these tips is a different sample, starting again at the beginning of gastrulation, going through convergent extension. And so far, we've only sequenced two of these time courses, and actually just got this data in last week, so it's waiting for me to be analyzed when I get back from the course. So, about it. Thanks. I'll take questions. And here is the Wallingford Lab at Fancy Grass Night.
So, what is your describing intercalation will be RNA, will come out of your RNA base versus differential expression of proteins,
collaboration
of proteins, and so on.
So that is actually a very good question. It is somewhat of a concern of ours that it's going to be purely exchanges in protein localization driving this dynamic behavior. But we do expect there will be some changing cell adhesion molecules, et cetera, that are only required for this process but not others. Like, for example, we know that the c-Kit here actually quickly turns off after convergent extension. So this gives us some hints that there are proteins there. Yeah.
So when do you think you've got more c-Kit on the shrinking junctions? I think in other systems you actually get less.
Yeah, so on the shrinking Tamal's Kui has shown that there's actually clearance of e-Kit here from the shrinking junctions in the epithelium. It's not what I think we see here.
But you don't have any theories about why that is?
Structurally, they're very different tissues. So I think the C-cadherin could be playing a very different role than E-cadherin in the epithelium. In the epithelium, most of the E-cadherins have these adherence junctions. Here, we actually don't know what the role is. It could be anywhere in the membranes. It's a very different system.
So, you've got this question, but they're quite deep cells, right? So they're 10 microns or more. So you've got this whole sheet of actin, cadherin, and that has to be coordinated across that depth.
Yes, correct. I may be naive, but I think that potentially we just have the cadherin and actin all along that depth. We have no reason to think it's not. When we go up and down the Z, we see cadherin everywhere. We see the actin all along that depth. But
So in your FRAP experiment, so are you also getting recovery from above and below?
It does not look
FRAP, you're just like
it doesn't look like we're getting recovery from above and below because you really clearly see it coming in laterally. But we also are opening the pinhole open wide and taking up pretty big section through the FRAP experiment.
So you said there are protrusion at the apical site.
Yeah, but it's not apical necessarily. There's not an apical basal polarity here. Just the bottom of the cells that are at the cover slip interface.
Okay, the protrusion are at the towards the extracellular matrix.
Yes, correct.
Can you manipulate the levels of C-cadherin down?
Yes, we can kind of tune it by the amount of mRNA we express, but we haven't tried knocking it down.
Yeah.
So yeah, knockdown is clearly one of the best experiments.
And when you put in more C-cadherin, what effect do you see on the equation?
So at some point you actually block convergent extension if you keep adding C-cadherin. So you have to kind of
just sticking everything together.
Yeah, presumably.